Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme, new perspectives on cancer that explain why the war on cancer has failed. My guest, Dr. Thomas Cowan, that's C-O-W-A-N, medical doctor. He's in San Francisco. He's a longtime holistic and complementary and alternative medical doctor. He practices in San Francisco. He's a former vice president for the Physicians Association for Anthroposophic Medicine. By the way, that's based upon the teachings of Rudolf Steiner. And he was a founding member of the Weston Price Foundation. He uses nutrition and homeopathy. He uses botanical herbs. He also operates a family-run biodynamic organic farm. Dr. Cowan writes the column Ask the Doctor for the magazine Wise Traditions in Food, Farming, and Healing Arts. He's authored several books, including Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. His most recent release, a couple of weeks ago, is Cancer and the New Biology of Water and Why the War on Cancer Has Failed and What That Means for More Effective Prevention and Treatment. We'll be speaking with him about these issues and emerging discoveries about certain unusual properties of cellular water that may, my hope is, force us to completely rethink the causes of our ongoing epidemic of cancer. His websites are drcowansgarden.com and also humanheartcosmicheart.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
I'd like to begin by sharing a little insight into a video that I watched, and I actually played on a noon program that I do, and it was about a medical doctor, a Chinese-American physician, whose mother developed cancer, and her mother told her that while she was fighting cancer, that she didn't want to be kept alive at the end if she was suffering. When she got the call about 5 or 6 years later that her mother was dying, she went to visit her, and in the hospital they were ready to start the heart-lung machine and other ways of keeping her alive longer. And she told the doctors, I don't want that. My mother doesn't want that, and I have to honor my mother's wishes. And they tried to play a guilt trip on her and say, but, you know, your mother should have every opportunity to live. And she agreed, but she said, my mother should also have every opportunity to know how she wants to die. And so she said it was the most difficult decision of her life, but she saw her mother pass, and that was an important closure for her. But also it opened her up to how insensitive doctors can be and how they're going by protocols rather than the need of the individual patient. She went on to talk about what she believed should be an important first step in seeing any doctor, and this is where I'm going to with you on this, that shouldn't you know if a doctor is profiting from a particular drug or therapy that doctor is advocating? Now, as an aside, when I was flying back to New York from West Palm Beach, where I'd just appeared on a PBS station, there was a person who came over to me, and we were talking, and then all the way back, we sat beside each other, and he told me the story of how he was a drug rep for a company that made arthritis-fighting drugs. And the interesting part of the story was that every doctor that used that drug on a patient got $500. And that many of the rheumatologists had 300 to 400 patients. Well, it doesn't take a whole lot of math to realize, let's just say that if you have you're getting $500 and you have 300 patients, you've just earned $150,000 in 1 year. And that's all cash income. So what is the incentive then to suggest that therapy versus some other therapy? And so she decided to ask the people, what do you want to know about your doctor? And it was interesting because a lot of people wanted to know, do you specialize in treating gays and lesbians, trans people? How do you feel about that? Do you believe in complementary alternative therapy? Would you be willing to use that? Do you believe in body-mind medicine and using that? And what do you charge? And what is the basis of your income? And she found that most people were pretty much the same of all the thousands of people who answered the question. So then she asked doctors, wouldn't this be good if we put all this about you on a site so patients could see about you and know more about you and what is realistic to pay for a procedure? Boy, did she get slammed, she said. Whoa. She was attacked mercilessly. She had death threats. She had bomb threats. People were writing to the California head of the medical board trying to revoke her license to practice medicine. All she wanted was simply an honest, open, transparent understanding of who the doctor is, what they're practicing, what's their specialization, not just where they went to school. And for that, she was smacked down. But she wasn't completely defeated, and she's still optimistic. Now, there are more than 900,000 doctors in the United States. Only 0.5% are practicing what you do, any form of complementary and alternative medicine. And yet of the five medical doctors who were practicing alternative medicine and were treating cancer, they had the highest independently confirmed cure rate for terminal cancer in the United States, such as Dr. Virginia Livingston Wheeler out in California, Dr. Emmanuel Ribisi in New York, Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski in Houston, Texas, Dr. Okaidi, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, and in Germany, Dr. Joseph Issels, the most successful alternative cancer therapy in world history. All of them denigrated, all attacked, all marginalized. So the very idea that you have chosen to use your distinguished medical background and to honor the patient and try to build up their immune system naturally, to use medicines only when absolutely necessary, is a rather radical concept. And right now, Wikipedia is calling people like you crazy names, like charlatans, delusional psychotics and charlatans. And they've never met you. They've never spoken with your patients. So before we go to the larger issue about cancer, shouldn't we talk about the way we have been indoctrinated to believe cancer should be treated, since almost 100% of all people get orthodox therapy and over 550,000 die every year by obeying their doctors without question, right up to where they're toe-tagged in the morgue, and they pay hundreds of thousands of dollars that is all the reward to the medical system, and no one seems to have any sense of humility or spiritual sensitivity that maybe they're doing it wrong if for the last 50 years they've been treating cancer and all you have is death in most cases, and at least a minimum of 20 million Americans have died of cancer using orthodoxy. Isn't it time that there be an open conversation without yelling and screaming and demeaning through identity politics with this, which is rampant in medicine, that maybe we got it all wrong on what causes cancer, maybe we got it wrong on how to prevent cancer, maybe we got it wrong on how to treat cancer? The forum is yours.
Thank you for that. I think I would say well said, but Gary, I want to throw something else in there, because I don't know whether you would agree with this, but I don't have any disagreement with any of that that you just said, but in a funny sort of way, and again, this, you may or may not agree with this, but what you said is not the worst of it. The worst of it, the thing that I think is at the bottom of what I was trying to say, and what the real problem is. Of course, there's problem with, you know, greed and financialization and the treatments and all that. All that's true. But I have come to the conclusion over my life as a human being and a medical doctor that the biggest problem of all is that we've been sold this theory that human beings, and in fact all biological life forces, are nothing but a collection of dead matter. And, you know, for all these, one of my favorite sayings is, the trouble with science is it's not very scientific. So when you go through training, you go through medical school, you go through residency, anything that smacks of there's more to a human being than just physical stuff is absolutely derided. Now, the irony of this is if you go to sort of modern quantum physics and you say, okay, well, what is physical stuff made of, right? So that's the whole thing. Anybody who talks about non-physical stuff, that there's a life force or a life body or a spirit or something, anything that has anything to do with living beings, that's just not permissible in modern science and modern medicine. And you say, okay, well, what is a physical stuff in the first place? Well, the physicists say the physical stuff is made of atoms, and 99.99% of the atom is just nothing, right? It's just space. So you say, well, how does 99.99% nothing make into a leg that feels solid? And nobody has an answer for that. And then you say, well, the physicists say that this matter, this stuff that we're supposed to study, that's the basis of everything. And if you say anything besides stuff, you're considered a lunatic. And the physicists say this stuff either is a wave or a particle. The particle is mostly, you know, empty space anyways. But we exist as a wave, which is not even stuff at all. And then, so how does this stuff that's a wave, that's not even stuff, how does this produce a human being or any living being? And the upshot of that is we study living systems, including people, as if they're dead. And to me, that's the overriding tragedy of this whole thing. And you're right, you can't even talk about this. Anybody who believes in, you know, like I sometimes ask people, they say, I only believe in stuff. So I say, do you love your wife? Yes. With all your heart? Yes. So if I cut open your heart, I would find some stuff in there called love. Well, obviously, no. You just told me you believed only in stuff, right? We're only made of stuff. There's no stuff in there. And in fact, the most important part of us is not stuff. And that's really what I wrote this book about. And the real essence of the book is the mediator between what we call life, or this life force, or energy body, or prana, or chi, or Steiner's etheric body, or whatever, and the physical, you know, reality is water. So we better study water, because that's how this life force organizes the stuff and makes sense of the stuff. Otherwise, we're just studying it as if we're dust. And to me, that's the real tragedy. And all the other tragedies that you mentioned come out of that central misconception of what is life.
Well said. Thank you. I find it rather ironic that the very people wanting to bring Greta in to the Economic Forum at Davos and speak with the world's leading polluters, the major powers of industry, are the very people polluting the planet the most, making the most profit off of it, and now want to exploit the profit of people's fear of global warming consequences, and they're going to win they will manipulate her, they will use her. Similarly, when a whistleblower risks their career and their entire life in many respects, because they could actually be executed for treason, they expose crimes against humanity. They are then found to be the guilty ones, and they're put into prisons, like Chelsea Manning, or if he came back, Edward Snowden, or he's now in prison, and for never having been wrong about anything, and that's Julian Assange. And yet the people who they expose for being criminals are rewarded. It's amazing the people who fail to run a corporation right are the ones who get all of the bonuses when they bankrupt the company, where the workers get nothing. Now, why do I say that? Because everywhere you look in our society, in every institution, from education, which has ceased to create critically thinking minds in many cases, to the financial industry that knows that it makes the most money when you can't afford to repay your bills and therefore puts you in constant chronic stress that can lead to all forms of disease, like miss a payday loan or miss student loan, and now you got compounding interest. And the only thing they think about is not how it's affecting you, how you could be arrested, how you could be put into new debtors' prisons, but you owe them something and they must take it. Similarly, one of the three most expensive procedures in all of medicine is treating cancer. And it's not uncommon to have people spend $300,000 before they die being treated for cancer. It also is the most unscientific of all the disciplines because, A, oncologists are allowed to buy chemotherapy or drugs at wholesale, let's say $5,000 for a month's injections, sell it to their patient at $12,000, and that spread is their profit without ever notifying the patient. But they are never held accountable either morally or professionally for failures. But they're all rewarded for their efforts, including when the patient dies. There is no vehicle right now in the United States to allow anyone to show me that by taking a particular drug and you don't die from the disease, that that drug was uniquely and exclusively responsible, because there's never been a double-blind placebo-controlled study. They say it's too unethical. That's the same true with vaccines. And yet, they say they're the only authorities on how to treat cancer. No one else has the right to, and you could be punished even if you treat patients for cancer, build up their immune system, help them overcome their cancer, and Dr. James Privateer was found guilty in California and was sent to work in a prison chain gang. When his wife came to see me to see if I could help him, and we did, we got Jerry Brown to get him out of that, his only crime was that he was found guilty of fraud. The fraud was he was not using current acceptable medical practice for cancer. He didn't deny chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. He simply said, let me use a lifestyle modification, a healthy plant-based diet, exercise and stress management, and supplements to build up your immune system. 247 patients showed up and wanted to give testimony. They were not allowed. There was Dr. Hansen, Dr. Privateer, all these other doctors that I have helped. Their only crime was helping people with cancer in this case, and they were punished by the state, and the entire media was against them because they were considered quacks. So when I look at medicine, I'm ashamed of what it's become. When I look at the intellectual capacity of doctors and their original idealistic intents and how that was captured by special interest groups or greed, I'm ashamed by that. When I hear this woman today on a TED Talk say that one of the people criticizing her was a doctor who says, it's no business of the patient how I make my money and how much I make. I have bills to pay. I have mortgage to pay. I have every right to charge whatever I can. And then you see $3.5 trillion being spent on medicine. And shouldn't that at some point resonate that something is terribly wrong with our entire medical industrial complex and specifically cancer?
Well, I can't disagree with you about that. I mean, we have a very sick system, and we have a very sick system across the board, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better anytime soon.
I want to pick up on something that you began, and I want you to really take your time and go into depth with it, because it's a very simple understanding at the at the lay language is very complicated at the technical end. So see if you can't give us the lay understanding of this. And that is that some of the exciting new areas of research that may change our entire understanding about the cause of cancer, and it's about the concept of the dominant oncogene theory that argues that genetic mutations are the primary cause for cancer. But for the sake of this conversation, please briefly summarize the underlying principle in the oncogene theory and how it relates to the most established medical procedure for treating cancer using chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. And then I'd like you to touch upon the remarkable work of the German medical researcher, Dr. Otto Warburg, that's Warburg, who received his Nobel Prize in medicine for his research into cellular respiration and how tumor cells generate energy. And I believe he was nominated for a second Nobel as well. And much of what Warburg was suggesting has been ignored for decades because he was associating cancer with a metabolic process, the use of energy and glucose. And he also posited that cancer might be a mitochondria disorder. Can you further elaborate on his work and how his oncology research had been showing he was correct, and at least partially so?
Okay, I mean, that's going to take me a while, but if you want me to do it, I can give it a try.
We got plenty of time. We have 45 minutes uninterrupted, so take your time.
Okay, so let me start with the oncogene things, and that's the first chapter in my book. So just to, and I'm going to try to make this as understandable as I can. In 1971, Nixon announced the war on cancer, and the reason he did that was because they had claimed or said at that time they had discovered the cause of cancer. Therefore, if we knew the cause, then we would spend whatever it takes over the next 10 years, and the prediction was that we would eliminate cancer over the next 10 years. Now, the rate of cancer in the population was around 1 in 4 or so then. In last year, it's about 1 in 2 or maybe even higher. And as you pointed out, there's been millions and millions of deaths, and we're nowhere near winning this so-called war on cancer. So you have to, at that point, look at what did they say was the cause of cancer. So they said the cause of cancer was oncogenes, otherwise known as the somatic mutation theory. And the way to understand that is if you look at a cell, it has two components. It's a membrane that encircles the cytoplasm, which is the watery part, and then inside there is a nucleus that houses the DNA, and the DNA is made out of basically genes. The somatic mutation theory means humans have 46 chromosomes, there's 22 pairs of somatic chromosomes, and then there's an X and an X and an X or a Y. The theory is, in one of those 22 pairs of somatic chromosomes, on one of the many genes that make up the chromosome, there's a defect or a mutation that somehow drives the cancer process. In the beginning, the prediction was that one of two things were going to be found. Either with all prostate cancer, there was going to be the same mutation, or with an individual with, say, prostate cancer, each cell was going to have the same, each cancer cell was going to have the same mutation. So either it was going to be tumor specific to the person, in other words, every one of your cancer cells has the same single mutation, or it was going to be to the type. In other words, all breast cancer has a single mutation. So this is what spawned the cancer industry, it spawned the biotech world, and there's been hundreds of millions, if not trillions of dollars, looking since then in the elucidation of these, which genes they are, what are they doing, etc. The problem was it quickly became apparent that if you look at 10 different people with prostate cancer, they all have wildly different somatic mutations. Some have 2 per cell, some have 100, some have 1,000, some have 10,000. And if you look at anyone's tumor, cell A in that one tumor has, again, two somatic mutations, cell B has 60, cell C has 3,004, et cetera, et cetera. So the thing became unfathomably complicated to the point where some oncologists have said, if it's oncogenes that are doing this, we'll never be able to solve this. So as more and more of these somatic mutations got identified, it just became so unbelievably complex that essentially nobody does anything about it. So even now, almost 50 years later, the therapies we use, surgery, radiation, chemo, have nothing to do with oncogenes. They have to do with killing cells or burning cells or poisoning cells so they don't divide. And this whole oncogene theory that we've spent hundreds of billions of dollars has amounted to mostly not much. Now, if you say, okay, so what does this mean? There was a very interesting set of experiments that throws light on the whole thing, and this is a little bit what you were alluding to. It turns out if you take two cells, two normal cells, and we can actually now transplant the nucleus from one cell into one normal cell into another normal cell, the progeny will be normal. So that's easy. Then you take a cancer cell and a normal cell, and you take the nucleus out of the cancer cell, and you put it into the healthy cytoplasm, and it turns out that progeny are healthy. And then you can reverse it, and you take the normal cell, you take the nucleus out of the normal cell, and put it into a cancerous cytoplasm, and it turns out the progeny are cancer. And this has been done over and over again. And it couldn't be more clear. It means the site of the cancer problem is in the cytoplasm, not the nucleus. And I'm going to actually repeat that because it's so shocking. It's not in the genes. It's not even in the nucleus. It's in the cytoplasm. And the interesting thing is some of the researchers are so enamored or blinded by this oncogene theory that they actually postulate that there must be something in the cytoplasm that can heal these defective oncogenes, which is totally ridiculous. It's not about healing the oncogenes. These oncogenes are simply a result of cellular deterioration. And so they're not the cause of anything. They, of course, you know, are not so-called good to have, because once your cell is deteriorating and you get all these crazy nuclear forms and nuclear deterioration, and then you get all these oncogenes and deterioration of the genes, that makes it worse. But that's not the driver of this. The driver is in the cytoplasm. And, you know, I like to speak in, like, metaphors and analogies. And the analogy that I gave in the book, it's like a guy's looking for something under a street light. And the policeman comes up and he says, "What are you looking for?" And the guy says, "I'm looking for my keys." And he looks for a little bit and then he says, "Where'd you lose them?" He said, "Over there in the bushes." And he says, "Well, why are you looking here under the street light?" And the guy says, "Because the light's better." And that's sort of our whole oncology establishment. The light is better in the nucleus. We think we understand genes and gene products and what they do, so the light is better there. But no matter what, if you lost your keys in the bushes, even if there's thorns or whatever, that's where you have to look. And so the problem is in the cytoplasm. Now, the Warburg effect that you referred to is very important here. However, I must say that I've come to the conclusion that the Warburg effect is itself, it's part of the problem, in fact, an integral part of the problem, but it's not the root understanding that I was looking for in my book. So the question then, how do I try to understand this? And you know, those of us who are trained in Goethe's way of observing the world, We start with what you can actually see. So in conventional so-called science, they start with the theory. So the theory is oncogenes cause cancer. Turns out that's not true. But then you're off to the races. So I didn't start like that. I started with, what do you see with cancer? Basically all tumors, at least all solid tumors, what you see and what you feel is the tumor feels different than the surrounding tissue. In other words, if you take a breast, which is an easy example, so a normal breast feels one way, and then you come to the tumor, and it feels totally different. In fact, it always feels the same. It feels like a hard rock in this otherwise soft tissue. And the same with a tumor in the pancreas, same with a tumor in the prostate, tumor in the lung. It's a increased density of the cells, which then you feel as a hard mass. And when you do scans, you're basically looking at the density of the tissue. So the scans tell you the density is too much, and that's how we know it's cancer. So the question then is, how did these cells become too dense? And I would say the answer to that is their spatial orientation is disturbed, or it's improper. So that obviously gets you into, well, how does the spatial orientation of a cell become normal in the first place? And let me describe what I mean by spatial orientation. And again, I sometimes make an analogy when I describe this to my patients. So when I'm sitting in my exam room, I'm usually about 6 feet away from the patient. If I, on the other hand, moved my chair all the way across the room and same person, same words, same clothes, etc., it changes everything. Or alternately, if I put my face 6 inches from the patient's face, my guess is they would run out of the room and say, this guy is a lunatic. Even though I might actually say the same thing, same person, same everything, but changing the space between us changes everything. Now, the reason a breast feels like it does, which is different than a liver or an eye, is the cells have a certain spatial orientation, or they keep their distance. And the distance is different depending on the tissue. It's different for the liver, it's different for the breast. But each tissue has a characteristic spatial orientation. So next question, how does this spatial orientation come about? Well, the answer to that in modern biology is it comes about because there's a charge or a halo of charge around the cells, and when two charged cells come together, they repel each other and keep their distance. And the strength of the charge determines how far apart they'll keep each other. So then the next question is, well, how does this halo of charges come about? And that gets into one of the central aspects of cell biology, which is, how does a cell live in a salt or sodium-rich environment, and yet it excludes the sodium from the inside and pushes the sodium to the outside and collects or concentrates potassium on the inside? And the result of that differential between sodium and potassium inside and outside, which was one of the central conundrums of biology for centuries, that actually creates the charge around the cells. We know that. So this has been studied, like I say, for centuries, and they said the answer is there's a pump in the membrane, so-called sodium-potassium pump. It pumps the sodium out and keeps the potassium in, pumps the potassium in. That creates a charge around the cells. Cells keep their distance. And if you lose the charge, then if you lose the sodium-potassium pump, the cell loses its charge. It clumps together, forms a tumor, and that's what we call cancer. Right? So that's very clear. Interestingly, though, a guy named Gilbert Ling, who is one of the best biologists who ever lived, definitively, and I mean definitively, proved that the sodium-potassium pump, one of the crowning achievements of modern biology, is basically mostly a myth, which to me isn't that surprising. And the reason he said that is because if you look at how much energy a sodium-potassium pump uses to do this charge differential, it's about 30 times more than the cell has available to it to do everything. This is analogous to having a $30,000 a month mortgage and your salary is $2,000. Eventually, it doesn't work. So then the question is, how does this charge differential, the sodium-potassium gradient, which is the charge differential, which is the basis of cancer, how does that come about? And it became very clear it comes about because of the unique properties of water. In other words, water and only water can exist in a previously unknown or misunderstood phase called a gel phase. So unlike all the other substances, which are either solid, liquid, or gas, water has a solid ice, a liquid water, and a steam gas. But it also has a gel phase. And it turns out, by some miracle of nature, that the gel that makes up 100% of the contents of our cytoplasm, in other words, that's why if you stab somebody, you don't leak water out, because it's a gel, like Jell-O. Our cytoplasm is a gel. And the mesh size of the gel is so constituted that it attaches to potassium and excludes sodium, no energy needed. That creates the pump. That creates the charge differential. It's interesting that Gerson, who came up with one of the most successful therapies for cancer, said it's all about sodium-potassium distribution. And he didn't know how the sodium-potassium got distributed, but he said, don't eat any sodium, eat a lot of potassium, and that might do it. So he was onto something, but because he didn't know how this gel was formed, so you form a gel, the gel collects the potassium, excludes the sodium, that creates a charge. The charge makes the cells align in a proper spatial orientation, and that makes tumors not form. So the next question, and this gets into the Warburg thing, how does the gel form? Well, it's similar to Jell-O. So how do you make Jell-O? You take proteins called gelatin, and you put water in it, and then you heat the mixture up, and then you cool it, and it forms a gel. That's what happens in a person. Now, the question, though, is what does the heat do? And what the answer is the heat unfolds the proteins. So you have these folded up, like in a ball, gelatin proteins. You heat them up. That unfolds them. That allows them to attach to the water. And then when they cool, they form a gel. That's exactly what happens inside our cells. In the cytoplasm, there's structural proteins. I think they're actin because I've seen them fluoresce. And they're in a folded state, and they can't interact with water. And then the question is, well, you can't put heat into a cell. You can't, like, put a Bunsen burner under your foot. So what Ling was able to discover is that the ATP, which most people think is the energy source of mammalian systems, but it's not. What it does is it binds to the end of these proteins, unfolds them, allows them to interact with water, and then they form gels. And the gels then create this charge, which makes it into a living system. And by the way, the gels also determine what part of the DNA will be expressed and how the proteins function. So everything that has to do with the nuclear function and the DNA is a function of the health of the gels. And so if you end up having an ATP deficiency because you have a mitochondrial defect, this is the Warburg effect, then you don't have the ATP to attach to the proteins, they don't unfold, they can't interact with water, you can't form gels, you don't have a charged cell, therefore you have a dysfunctional cell. You can't organize the expression of the DNA. The DNA starts getting mutated, the proteins don't work, and then you have cancer. And that's exactly how it happens.
Let me just summarize that in lay language. So now you're talking about the new biology of water, in effect water in the fourth state. You touched briefly upon that matter exists in three states, a solid, a liquid, and a gas. However, now you're stating that water can exist in a fourth state, which lies somewhere between a liquid and a solid, more like a gel, and that is the state of much of the water in our bodies, especially our cytoplasm. In the future, by the way, I hope to be able to invite on this program Professor Gerald Pollack at the University of Washington, who has perhaps done the most research on this fascinating subject, at least that I'm aware of, because fourth state water has some very unusual properties. And you were just describing some of these properties and why it's, you know, so important to understand how this creates healthy cellular function. And then this relates also to a great understanding of the onset of cancer as a metabolic disorder rather than as a mutagenic disorder. And therefore, there were two great minds, Bichamp and Pasteur. And Pasteur believed that it was the microbe, the microorganism, that caused disease. But Bichamp said, no, it is the medium, meaning it is the entirety of the environment. That would include your diet, the quality of the water, how much sleep you get, all the other intermittent factors that can contribute to wellness or disease. So when we look at a homeopathic physician, and by the way, one of those people practicing homeopathy today is none other than Professor Luc Montagnier from Institut Pasteur, who won the Nobel Prize singularly, not with Robert Gallo, for his discovery using water or homeopathy, which is principally water, but diluted, and that it has energy. And it has the memory of what it once did actively. So that would give us this idea. So for those people, you mentioned briefly Max Gerson. Now, Max Gerson was a German physician who ran a tubercular ward in Germany, and he found that people got worse by Monday, and he didn't work over the weekends. And when he came to the work and the clinic on the weekends, he found that people were eating pork and sausages and other types of highly salted food. You mentioned that he was the one who created the notion of put a lot of potassium, there's your fruits and juices, and low sodium. So his diet was one of low salt, hence the traditional highly salted and preserved with sodium nitrate foods were restricted. And lo and behold, within 2 years, he was the leading person in Germany recovering people with tuberculosis and other types of conditions such as that. He wrote many papers on it. In fact, he wrote a textbook on it. Then he found that some of his cancer patients were benefiting. So by the time that the Nazi regime forced him out of Germany and he resettled in the United States, first in California, he actually was brought before Congress, and there was a Senator Pepper, Claude Pepper, who was from Florida at the time, and Pepper not only acknowledged him, but actually suggested a medal of honor to him because he brought 50 cases of terminal patients and their meticulous medical documentation, and that it was through the Gerson diet, 13 to 15 glasses of juice a day, at that time principally carrot juice, apples also, and fermented foods.
And liver probiotics, juice, by the way. Liver
juice. I know, and that was terrible. Yeah. Well, we got to give him credit for not being perfect. But he was able to have remarkable treatments that worked. Now, he was very innovative. And I went to visit his clinic. I went to film people three times. And his daughter, who recently passed, Charlotte Gerson Strauss, was a very committed person. But she had a big weakness. And I told her this. I said, your father was an innovator. He was constantly adjusting and changing. You have immortalized his work trying to help people, but there's no change. You're not using bioexudative therapies. You're not using ozone. You're not using intravenous vitamin C drips, the things I was using at the Institute of Applied Biology and reversing AIDS, and also at the Tri-State Healing Center with our whole team of doctors. We were reversing every disease. And I said, why not try? And she wouldn't. She refused to. So I just stopped sending people there because I wasn't seeing the results. But also, we should understand that people today who are juicing, who are in modified fast, who are reducing their caloric intake, which also helps prevent cancer and reduces the aging process, to the healthy calories we need, and also reduce metabolic syndrome in the process. By reducing metabolic syndrome, by being on a healthy plant-based diet, you're also juicing and taking in living foods like sprouts, and then supplementing with a supplement such as nicotinamide, adenine dinucleotide, or hydride, which is NADH, which is a biological form of hydrogen naturally found in our bodies, and it's a molecule that has been well studied in cancer trials. And out of the curiosity, before today's broadcast, I did a quick search on the National Institute of Health's PubMed database, and I found, are you ready for this? 77,000 peer-reviewed articles citing NADH and now NAD. So would you take us, is that an accurate summary or not? If not, please correct it. And then take us into what you are seeing with NADH or NAD helping people as well.
There's some things that we could talk about, but I think I'll just go on here and say, so basically then I looked at what creates healthy water and what doesn't create healthy water. And, you know, and Pollock has done a lot of experiments where you can see water moving in tubes. And you can actually see directly what creates healthy water and what doesn't. Because the more things flow in the tubes, essentially that means the stronger the gel has formed, and that's what we're looking for. And I would say, in order to form a healthy gel, you need two components. You need healthy water, and you need the energy source. So how do I know that? Because if you put water in a beaker and put a horizontal hydrophilic tube, you'll see flow. But if you put it in a lead box, the flow stops. If you shine the sun on it, which becomes the energy to form the gels, then the flow increases. If you put the beaker on the earth, then the flow increases. If you put your hands on the beaker, the flow increases. If you put your dog next to the beaker, the flow increases. If you put glyphosate in the water, the flow stops. If you put your cell phone next to the water, the flow stops. So we know there's healthy energy, and there's also healthy water, and there's healthy energy. Now, when you get to NADH, NADH is the source of hydrogen. And, you know, we know that water is made out of H2O, so you need hydrogen to form healthy water. And NADH is one of the, you know, rate-limiting steps for the formation of ATP, which we just learned ATP is necessary for forming the healthy gels. Now, you know, when I say NADH is the hydrogen donor, it turns out there's other kind of water we have, which is called D2O, which is otherwise known as heavy water or deuterium-rich water. And we know, from studies on this that people who accumulate more D2O in their cells, number one, it affects mitochondrial function, so you get less energy. But to me, more so, it creates a dysfunctional gel because the D2O is not the right size. It doesn't have the right physical characteristics of H2O. So anytime you can substitute H2O for D2O, you create healthier gels, which are more receptive and are better at creating this charge, and better at essentially directing the expression of the DNA, and better at helping the proteins form in space properly so they can do their function properly. So NADH is both the supplier of hydrogen and the stimulator or the rate-limiting step for the production of ATP, both of which are needed for the formation of healthy gels, which I would argue is the key to this whole kingdom.
That's very interesting. Would you, now for the time we have remaining, would you discuss the work of Rudolf Steiner, one of the most important visionaries of the 20th century? And he predicted so many things, but especially the balance we must live in with nature in order to remain sustainable. And also, finally, briefly tell us your position on vaccines and autoimmunity. We've written 50 articles on vaccines, Richard Gell and myself, for the last 3 years, and we're very concerned that the real science does not support their universal use for safety and efficacy, and certainly not mandatory usage. Your thoughts, please.
So Rudolf Steiner was not a doctor, but he was a scientist of sort and a philosopher. And basically, I would say the relevance of Steiner to this discussion is two things. One, he was, you know, very clear that the human being is not just physical stuff, like I said in the beginning, but actually has three other, quote, bodies. The first body called the etheric body or the water body, and the second the astral body or the soul, and the third was the ego or the spirit. And he said the problem with cancer lies in the water body, which is exactly what I'm saying. And he said the mistletoe, which is the cancer medicine that he inaugurated, is a therapy for the water body. And that's a lot of the cases in my book are people who used mistletoe injections. And so I essentially extended that, you know, anthroposophical doctors, which I would say I'm not because I have certain disagreements, but they say only mistletoe. And I say, well, what about the water? And there's so many other components that have to do with whether you have healthy water in your cells and tissues, that it's true, I think, that mistletoe is the stimulation for creating healthy water, but they refuse to look at the actual water and how the water is formed, which I think is a mistake. Now, the other thing that's relevant is the very foundation of anthroposophical thinking and medicine. It could be encapsulated by the following. The human being is a being that has a physical body and a water body and a soul and a spirit, and that the growth of the child is these higher bodies, these soul and spirit, essentially use childhood illnesses to mold the physical body so that it becomes an instrument uniquely suited to its own needs. In other words, to put that in simple language, your spirit uses measles, mumps, chicken pox, etc., to create a more perfect vesicle or vehicle. And that there is the tragedy of a medical system that has decided to essentially have a war on childhood diseases. There's, of course, many other issues, which I'm sure you pointed out, which is the toxicity of the vaccines and the heavy metals and the fact that they absolutely cause autoimmune disease and a whole host of other things, which I don't want to get into right now. I mean, I wrote a whole book on that. But really, the central tragedy is this is how the human being grows. You're a child, you use warmth, you use remodeling of childhood illnesses to create a vessel that suits your spirit. And so the prediction is, if you don't allow that to happen, you will have all these people who feel uneasy, uncomfortable, unfit to live in their physical body. And that is basically a description of the modern human being. They feel uneasy. This is not the way I want to live. My life doesn't feel right. I don't fit. And therefore, you get all these diseases of, basically, it's an inappropriate connection. That's what we have. That's the tragedy of this whole thing.
I appreciate your insights. Thank you very much, Thomas Cowan, for coming on and sharing them with us.
Okay. Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up? This is a
good party, man.
Yeah, brother,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
Hey, man.